15. I do not recall telling you who was in command of the local home guards in the fighting in Augusta against Basil Duke's brigade of Morgan's command. It may have been Colonel Bradford, but it certainly wasn't Mother's father. All I recall hers saying that she saw her father, Dr. Bradford, and father's father conferring at this time, and that was the only time she ever saw them talking to each other. I have nothing more to add to this. I read The Youth's Companion when I was a boy. There was Harper's Young People, I believe, but I didn't read that. There was the Nicholas magazine, too, but I didn't read that. I started my writing after I entered the Army. I made the one visit to the White House I described when McKinley was present, and I was never in the White House again until I was Deputy Chief of Staff. No, until I was aide to General Pershing. And I was there several times with him and very frequently in the executive office of the Secretary to the President in connection with business that had some relation to General Pershing. I remember sitting out on the south veranda of the White House on the last day President Harding was there, and he and the General Pershing were waiting for the parade of the Masons, the Masonic orders, to arrive, and it was an hour late, so they had quite a discussion there between themselves, and a part of it was in relation to General Dawes, who was then organizing the Budget Bureau. Dawes was very violent about a good bit of it, and he particularly wanted to have the Secretary of the State down, compelled to report to him on all their expenses, rather than require him to go search with their understrappers about the thing. He wanted each man, the head of his own, each cabinet officer, the head of his own department, and accountable himself for it, and he, the budget chief, in a position to dominate the investigation. This was very unpopular with them all, and I remember they were the president assembled them all in some building there, and Dawes conducted the affair. And I remember his describing one scene in which he took a broom and swept. The thing was, the Navy had a lot of brooms of one kind, and the Army had a lot of brooms of another kind, and the one couldn't use the other's broom. Well, he thought that was reaching the peak of the absurdity, and he made quite a funny business out of it. But he pretty much made everybody mad. But he did get the budget going and did make it a very effective bureau. It lost its great prestige when he moved out. It lost its rather dominating power when he moved out, but it still became a very influential and dependable bureau. But he created from the start. I got a pretty good insight to the thing because he would come in and talk about it after and before these affairs to General Pershing, and he'd talk to me because he was so full of it. He'd talk every time he sat down about these things, and he'd sit in my office and talk to me sometimes by the hour. So I was very familiar with these goings-on, as you might call them. Then I went to the, and I went, then I went to the White House when I became Deputy Chief of Staff, but very officially and very few times. I had to go, of course, to the Army Navy receptions, things of that sort. But I remember I had to wear the special full dress with long tails, and I had no cape to go with it. So I wore an overcoat over this, which made rather an absurd setup. But I was so stony broke in those days that I couldn't afford the cape, and I just didn't have it. I don't know how many times I'd been to the White House before I became chief of staff, but I had was present at several serious conversations with the president while I was deputy. And I remember, I don't remember any conversations with the president much. I'm thinking more of those that occurred while I was chief of staff. One of the first ones was quite an assembly of men and a great many of the New Deal protagonists, but it had to do with these appropriations we were trying to get of a military way. And there was a great difference of opinion as to what it should be. And the president, of course, was all for the increase in the air, but he wasn't much for the training, getting the men to man the airships, nor for the munitions and things that they required. He was principally thinking at that time of getting airships for England and for France, but the French requirement quickly disappeared as France fell to the Germans. I remember the first one of these large conferences I attended. I believe I've told you this before. I sat on a lounge way off to the side. I was deputy this time, and the president finally got around to me. Most of them agreed with him entirely and very little to say, and were very soothing in their comments. And he, of course, did the major portion of the talking, and he finally came around to me. I was on the end, sitting on a lounge there, and he I remember he called me George. I don't think he ever did it again. But anyway, that rather irritated me because I didn't know him on that basis. Of course, the president can call you pretty much what he wants to, but nevertheless, I wasn't very enthusiastic over such a misrepresentation of our intimacy. So he turned to me at the end of this general outlining, which he'd done most of the talking, and said, "Don't you think so, George?" And I replied, "Mr. President, I'm sorry, but I don't agree with that at all." And I know that ended the conference, and the president gave me a very startled look, and when I went out, they all bade me goodbye, said my tour in Washington was over. But I want to say, in compliment to the president, that that didn't antagonize him at all. Maybe he thought I would tell him what was the truth so far as I was personally concerned, which I certainly tried to do in all our later conversations. He thought I was too intent on things, of course, and he was having a very hard time raising the public backing for the money, and there was a debt limitation during these early periods. But my job was to see that the country was armed if it was possible to do so, which meant large appropriations. I went into the White House once to see Mr. Coolidge when I was with General Pershing, but that was to go with the group who were and second an invitation. I had nothing to say myself. I was thinking I went in once when Mr. Hoover was present, but I can't recall it. I know when President Harding died that Mr. Hoover was on the funeral train when he came back from San Francisco. And I was there too because the car, which General Pershing and I were traveling at the time this occurred, was hitched to that train and we lived on that car. I did not know any of the presidents intimately before F.D. Roosevelt. With regard to my arm, it never was treated. They were very advised very strongly against trying any operation. What had happened was a tendon had been pulled some way in my boys' performances of football or something, football I guess, and the arm had gotten out of its regular joint and it virtually had to make a new joint. And it was quite painful in those days. It was very painful when I went to the VMI. If anyone brushed into me or touched me, well, it hurt quite a bit. And that got gradually better through the years, but it took quite a few years for that pain to wear off. And now I just can't use that arm in the normal way. I have to bowl instead of pitching, and I have to hook instead of striking out straight, and so on. I know my riding was different from other people's, so I rode a tremendous amount. I didn't dare have my left, didn't dare hold the reins partly with my left hand, because I would not be able to pull up the horse if he stumbled, because my right hand I knew would be gone because of my right elbow. So I rode with the reins in one hand, my right hand, and was prepared to make a short grasp with the left if anything went wrong, which occasionally it did. You refer to typhoid fever. I had all the common diseases of that day, it seemed to me. And as I recall, neither my sister nor my brother did. I had typhoid fever, I had measles, I had scarlet fever, and I think I went right down the line. I was a great obligation to the family. I know I had, when I was with scarlet fever, I was delirious, the only time I remember being delirious in my life. And the typhoid fever was a very long siege, which put me out of business for months and months. The next question regarding where I was born, I've already answered. If I gave the impression that General Pershing told the story of the old man in the barnyard up in near the Newmarket battlefield, I misled you a little bit, because he didn't retell the story exactly. He referred to it, but I think it is rather a brief reference. I read a little of Dickens and a little of Hugo, or rather it was read to me, but I can't even remember just which books they were. I know it wasn't the Dickens books I commonly remember. I remember Ouija, Under Two Flags, but I think I read this myself. To go back to the last question before this, General Pershing wasn't very good at telling stories in his speeches. He could tell them otherwise sitting around, though he was rather restrained, and he was not a free talker. He would sit up with me and talk until midnight, particularly on the train. Barely ever go to bed before midnight, and he was very, very sociable and rather youthful in his approach. But he didn't tell many stories. He told me about his youth. It is just a straight factual account, and I think was probably much more correct than mine about mine, my youth. I remember one absurd thing we had happen on the train, and I might say that it was very agreeable traveling with General Pershing, because he seemed to be as young as I was when we were getting about until we got home, and then it was business. We'd always be laughing at some joke when we drove up from the train in Washington, but when I came to the office, when he'd come in about 11 o'clock, it was just business as though we hadn't been together before. We were up in Lowell, Massachusetts, where he had to make a speech. And when we got on the car, on which we had a stateroom, Senator Moses was on the train, which came down and hooked onto the car. Somebody had given General Pershing a fine quart of whiskey, Scotch, I believe. And he had been drinking some of it. And he looked at the bottle. He said, "Now there's just enough for you and I and a little bit left over for a parting drink." It was then about 1 o'clock in the morning. So he said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give this scotch to Senator Moses." Drinks were very hard to get in those days. Real whiskey and not hooch whiskey, as we call it otherwise. So he poured out the remaining scotch in the drink for Senator Moses, and I went down the aisle carrying the drink, and he followed me in his shirt sleeves without a collar. I was about the same way, dressed about the same way. And we came to the berth that we had heard Senator Moses state he was cashed in. And General Pershing scratched on the hanging and whispered Senator Moses. And Senator Moses didn't reply. And he scratched again and said Senator Moses, and lifted the curtain a little bit when this young woman's voice came and said, "What do you want?" Well, he turned and ran against me, and we spilt the scotch between us all over us and raced down the aisle, and I had a hard time keeping out of his way because he was run right up my back. But we got into the stateroom and got the door shut, and then he just sat down there and laughed and cried. We had no more scotch, but I think there was a little bit, and he suggested I go back with it, and I told him he had to get another aid. I was going back out there again. But in the morning when we got off in the station in New York, we found sitting outside our stateroom door, where a berth had been made up, Senator Moses and the young lady that we'd tried to rout out of her stateroom. She'd known him, and she told him what had happened, and he identified General Pershing and me as being the culprits, and we had a very amusing back and forth in regard to it. He was very youthful in that way, not at all a stern disciplinarian, one would think. And I might say now, in regard to General Pershing, I've never seen anybody who could listen to his severe criticisms, particularly personal criticisms, just as though it was about a man in another county. He never held it against you personally. He might not agree with you in any degree, but he would listen to very, very frank criticisms in regard to his actions, in regard to the event, or whatever it was he said, or corrections if his memory had gone bad. But as a rule, his memory was very accurate. And he was conservative to the point that he wouldn't say anything unless he really was pretty certain of what the facts were. So we traveled together a great deal, and it was not at all boring. Often we'd just take the car where we were and go off on our own to this place and that place and the other place as the thought occurred to him at the time and as we found the people at home. But it was pleasant, it was entertaining, and he was far more youthful in his reactions and conversation than the officers, very little my senior, were, it seemed to me. But it was always rather astonishing because he was supposed to be a very severe character. He was anything but that in his normal reactions. But when we got back to Washington, and after he'd gone home and changed and freshened up and came back to the office and I came in to see him, he was just as stern as though we'd never been together at all. I can tell one incident about General Pershing while I think of it that shows pretty much what kind of a man he was to deal with, having in mind the stern qualities that he displayed. There was something came up. General Harbord was deputy chief of staff then, and he brought it to General Pershing, and they were going to change this. General Pershing had a way of sending most all these things into me. Nobody knew about it, and all he would put on the paper was Colonel M. And it was up to me to take a look at it and tell him what I thought. But that was never betrayed outside of the office, that I was put in this position of maybe criticizing my superiors. Well, in this particular case, he had decided, and an agreement with the General Harbor Board, and it was about something that General March had done, and they were changing it. And I thought they were entirely wrong. And when I got this paper with Colonel M. on it, I dictated a little memorandum to General Pershing to that effect, why I thought they were wrong, and so on. General Pershing sent it back to me, sent for me, and I came in, and he said, I don't take to this at all. I don't agree with you. Well, I said, let me have it, General. Let me have it again. I didn't express myself well. And I took it back in there and very carefully drew up my resume of the affair and why I thought was wrong. And he sent for me again. He said, I don't accept this. I think Harbord and I are right. And I was very much upset because I thought it was entirely wrong. And I said, well, now, General, I've done a poor job on this. Let me have that paper again. So I took it back and rewrote the whole thing to give it a brand new flavor. And then I took it in and handed it to him. And he read it and he put it down and he said, no. And as I recall, he slapped his hand on the desk, which is something I never heard him do before, had him do before, and said, no, by God, we'll do it this way. I got the paper back into my hand, and I said, I remember this pretty clearly. I said, now, General, just because you hate the guts of General March, you are setting yourself up, and General Harbord, who hates him too, to do something you know damn well is wrong. And he looked to me and handed me the paper. I didn't have it before. Handed me the paper and said, well, have it your own way. And that was the end of this scene where he was bitterly determined to do this, and yet he ended up by saying, have it your own way, which I thought was very remarkable. No prolonged feeling, nothing. That was the end of the affair. I don't think it was quite the end of the affair so far as General Harbord is concerned. But General Pershing held no griefs at all. He might be very firm at the time, but if you convinced him that was the end of that, he accepted that, and you went ahead. The books you mentioned, Sir Nigel and others, I read later on in my life. They were not read to me, but they were great, great favorites of mine. And when I come up to Leesburg, I'll tell you something that concerned the Sir Nigel series, which involved King George and the Queen Mother, and later on Princess Margaret, and finally Princess Elizabeth, and finally Elizabeth the Queen, which I had to do with the Punch Bowl down in Surrey and one of my trips there. You must be very careful to caution George and Miss Spillman not to mention any of these stories that you happen to read to them. In fact, it makes me rather timorous to realize that all of these intimate recollections will be on file and I suppose read by people. Because I think it's pretty much an overdose of childhood. And I go back to thinking in the end maybe it is better just to have the cherry tree story and nothing else, rather than this long list of affairs that looked like I was trying to make a great career of my childhood. I'm going to try to collect in my mind a number of items about the war which haven't been mentioned, and you would not find in the record. There's several quite important that I think of from time to time, and I will note them down and try to get them together. I think they'll probably have to be done in sequence. In that way, I can probably remember them better. Well, that is all for the present.